You can't put an intervention in place without considering the whole system.
IPC is really important.
COVID-19 has forced people very painfully to recognize the importance of public health in general.
People have to see what's in it for them.
Understanding how people think, what they feel, what their experiences are, what drives their behavior.
COVID-19 has highlighted all of the inequalities and the fractures in the system.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of LSHTM Viral. I'm Amy Thomas. People's actions and behaviour has a substantial impact on the spread of infectious diseases like COVID-19, TB and Ebola. Understanding the social factors is essential for public health solutions that are effective and long-lasting. In this episode, we explore the role of social science, anthropology and epidemiology in infection prevention control, and using this in combination with other research areas in what's known as a systems approach to health policy. I'll be speaking to three researchers from Amoya Umushle, a project that is tackling TB prevention and control in South African health clinics. First, I'm delighted to chat to Professor Karina Keelman. Karina is co-principal investigator of the project and has 15 years of experience applying social science theory to global health issues. Karina, what exactly do we mean by a systems approach to health policy?
It's been probably about a good two decades now with the Alliance for Health Policy and Systems Research that kicked off researchers sort of thinking about health systems more broadly. And they started off by borrowing really from systems theory, which is more frequently applied in the natural sciences to think about kind of complex biological, physical, or chemical systems. So in that way, they applied principles that were commonly found in the natural sciences to a social science understanding of the health system. And that basically just means that instead of looking at health systems components or performance of health systems through a set of indicators, instead they started to identify what are the central components of the health system. And not only what are the central components, but how do these components work together as a system? So by components, I mean things like the health workforce, medicines and technologies, the infrastructure, the information systems, and then of course, overall governance and funding. So those are what's known as the sort of building blocks or the fundamental components of the health system. And when we talk about a systems approach, it's essentially just reminding us that we're never really looking at those components in isolation, but that they're all dynamically interconnected. So systems thinking looks at those interconnections and recognizes that if you introduce something new into the system, let's say we're introducing a new diagnostic technology, we're actually concerned with all aspects of the system and how they will impact on the implementation of that diagnostic technology. So we might need to change health worker skills, we might need to put new technology in place, we might need an addition to information systems to be able to record what's being diagnosed and so on. So changing one thing has a knock-on effect on other things, and that has, you know, can be seen both in positive and negative terms, because obviously if we change some functional components, that may have a positive effect on, say, quality of care. But similarly, if we withdraw or we have, for example, shortages of one element, whether it's staffing or drugs, that's going to have a knock-on effect on the whole system.
What happens if you just take a siloed approach, for example, in TB, which you're looking at in South Africa?
Well, what happens is what we did for a very long time, is that we often looked at, you know, TB as we did for other vertical programs for infectious diseases, and said that what are the things that are missing? So we need better diagnosis. So taking a siloed approach would say we're lacking adequate technology to be able to, let's say, you know, diagnose drug-resistant TB. So you put the technology in place and you scale it up, but you haven't actually thought about the other aspects, which is what's going to happen if the machines break down? Do we have the skills in place to be able to implement that diagnostic technology? Are patients going to find the new mode of diagnosing TB acceptable? What is this going to mean in terms of the repercussions for other aspects of the system that might now be neglected because a lot of health workers are preoccupied with the new technology and how to work it. So from a systems perspective, we are really emphasizing that you can't put an intervention in place without considering the whole system. And if you only focus on functional components like more funds or more health workers or more knowledge and training on this particular aspect, but you're not thinking about how that's going to affect the rest of the components, things are never delivered on a blank slate. And that's probably the most important message that a systems thinker would give you, is that we're always thinking about what is the system that we're implementing something within, and how can we characterize it, and what does it mean for the technology or the intervention that's being put in place.
The classic thing for TB has been wearing masks.
This is Dr. Sanj Karat, research fellow at LSHTM, also working on TB in South Africa. Part of Sanj's research looks at the way people move in health clinics and how this affects their exposure to TB.
We know that it's really effective. If healthcare workers wear respirators and patients wear masks, or everybody visiting clinic wears a surgical mask, that cuts transmission by a massive amount. But actually doing that in practice is quite difficult. A big part of that is understanding the people, really, because it's people who need to do these things. So it's understanding how people think, what they feel, what their experiences are, what drives their behavior, how they interact, how they move through space, how they visualize space, and cultural aspects, historic aspects. And you can't leave politics out of it. Politics and policy drive everything from above. And if you're not aware of what's coming before and where the priorities are and where things are moving within the health system, you don't really know how best to slot in what you're trying to do into something that's continuously moving.
It seems almost like an obvious thing to include in infection prevention control. Historically, there was a traditional view of how we solve these problems in silo. Why do you think this kind of thing has been missed out?
Things are changing to an extent, so our understanding of these problems is improving, and we are, I think, getting better at learning from other disciplines. And I think some of the silo thing is partly because of the way funding structures were set up initially. And so if you've got money, you've got money just to do TB work, or you've got money just to do a particular thing. So much of this comes down to the way grants and programs are structured initially, and that constrains where and how much you can work.
And once we have the research, how do we communicate back to people on the ground in a sensitive and a nuanced way?
Making it interactive and engaging people in the process has really helped. And yeah, as you said, being respectful is a really big part of it. People have been working around this for years. That's really been a big finding. You know, I think we sometimes come in as external researchers and think we have all the answers. But it's really the people who work with this every day, who face these problems every day and have been trying to fix them. There's so much knowledge there and so much experience. And if we don't try to learn from that and make it a collaborative experience, then I really think we lose out.
There's such a challenge in, you know, as we mentioned, culture and values and people's views and attitudes, how you would go about trying to implement change in that area when it's something so embedded within a culture or, you know, a community. It seems like such a big task.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's about understanding it first and not sort of wading in, first of all, thinking that you know best, but understanding how to package sounds like marketing, and that's not really what we're trying to do, but it's about putting things in a way that fit best into the system. So contextualizing things and molding them to the shape of what already exists.
Do you think that this type of methodology is essential for IPC? Do you see the future of research really trying to incorporate multifaceted research instead of that sort of siloed approach that we mentioned before?
Research is obviously a broad church in that sense, and you know there are very well established methods that exist for answering particular types of questions. that do very well at answering those questions. So, I mean, an obvious example, you wouldn't necessarily use an approach like this to answer a question about a molecule or a particular drug. But I think for something that's, we're implementing a complex or trying to develop and implement complex interventions to complex dynamic systems. And, you know, I think we've been trying to do that for a long time without necessarily articulating it in the same way. And none of these, and, you know, system dynamics modeling is one of several systems mapping methods, and all of them have their strengths and weaknesses. And they're just tools at the end of the day. They're ways to visualize things. The first step of epidemiology or the first thing that people talk about is know your epidemic. And I think you can extend that really to beyond just, you know, who has the disease and how long do they have it and how do they transmit it, to some of the why and the how of interactions and processes and systems and information within that system.
What would you highlight as a key takeaway from this type of work in infection prevention control?
You know, it's prevention at the end of the day. So what you're trying to do is stop people from getting sick, which seems like a very worthwhile thing to do. And it's also a smart thing to do in healthcare settings. I mean, the rates of TB in healthcare workers in high burden countries are 4 to 6 times that of the general population. We've seen that with COVID. I mean, even here in the UK, the number of healthcare workers getting COVID and dying from COVID, which is obviously horrific in itself. But from a sustainability health systems perspective, healthcare workers are one of your key resources. And having healthcare workers becoming unwell is a disaster, obviously for them and their families, but also for the health system at large. So my takeaway is that IPC is potentially boring, but really important, and we need to take it seriously. We've known for a long time what should work, but we need to do better at figuring out how to actually make those things work in different settings.
There are a range of lessons.
This is Alison Schwartz from the University of Cape Town. Alison has been exploring the links between TB in South Africa and the current COVID-19 pandemic.
So the first is about masks, and masks do protect people. Mainly if you're wearing a cloth mask, you're protecting other people from you rather than you being protected. But what we also know from the context of TB is that it's very, very difficult to get people to consistently and correctly wear their masks. The second thing is that, and this is really true in the South African context, and I think that we've made this mistake in South Africa with other conditions before. We need to be thinking about COVID-19 as one of many things that affects the South African population and the global community. It affects certain people more than others, but the management and treatment of COVID-19 hopefully can be integrated into existing care structures that we have. We have to manage, and this is a really, really key point in general, we have to find new ways to reduce people's waiting times in clinics and reduce the number of people in waiting areas in clinics, because in South African primary healthcare facilities, they're notoriously very, very crowded, and people can often sit for a whole day in a facility, which would of course be a time when COVID and TB could spread. And it's interesting because there seems to be quite a lot of, I mean, I wouldn't call it resistance to queue management and appointment systems in facilities, but just in the context of other research that I've done in facilities in townships in the Western Cape, there have been attempts made to start a queue system, but that doesn't necessarily stop people from arriving at the facility very, very early in the morning. And then the facility will be full, 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 waiting rooms full in the morning. But if you go back in the afternoon, oftentimes you'll find they're pretty empty. So it would be better if we had people kind of spreading themselves out in relation to the use of the facilities across the day. And the other thing is that we need really good, clear policy, but we also need to be cognizant of the challenges that persist in relation to the implementation of policy. So, and that goes for TB, IPC policy, and policy related to the management of COVID-19 transmission.
Knowledge doesn't translate easily into behavior change. We tend to, in public health, often target individuals, and we think that we're going to bring about individual behavior change by working, let's say, with specific managers or health workers or patients. But in fact, what we see with a systems approach is that a collective buy-in is really essential. So if you want to change individual behaviors, be it around wearing masks or be it around disinfecting your hands or any other principle of IPC, opening windows, you need to create a kind of organizational culture where collectively people think that's the right thing to do. And it becomes the norm and it becomes taken for granted as opposed to something that is perceived as, you know, a one-off or something that's a bit out of the ordinary. And we see that definitely in countries. I mean, Germany currently, there's a much higher degree of population buy-in. Why? Probably because the government was very transparent about how many cases there were, what was happening in the country. They were very, very proactive about contact tracing. They were proactive about making masks available, so that it's very common here to see, for example, a dispenser, a mask dispenser. So there's mask dispensers everywhere. So it's just become second nature that, you know, if you're caught short outside of the shop, you just buy one for €1. So that's the issue around, you know, creating a collective buy-in, a sense of collective behavior change.
Might it work to incentivize people in some way to come to the clinic at a different time to the time that they usually would have been used to coming to the clinic? Might it be that patients who are stable on treatment for TB can receive, you know, packages of a couple of months worth of medication to reduce the number of times that they even need to attend the facility? How can we engage with healthcare workers and healthcare managers to encourage patients, but also staff, to work with a queue or appointment system that reduces the time that people are spending in facilities, but also maintains careful social distancing or encourages appropriate and consistent mask wearing?
What impact has COVID-19 had on the work of Amoya Omushle and for IPC in general?
COVID-19 has forced people very painfully to recognize the importance of public health in general, to think about what risk and safety mean in the context of an infectious disease, and to think about how countries and health systems might or might not be able to cope with a pandemic like this. And in South Africa, COVID-19 has highlighted all of the inequalities and fractures in the system which existed before, which is partly what the work of the Amoya Omushle project is looking at. TB doesn't affect the South African population equally. There are a whole range of social and biological conditions which make some people more susceptible to contracting TB than others. And the painful reality is that if you are living in more crowded conditions, if you are poorer, if you are working in a mine or in a condition where people are very kind of vulnerable and close together, you are more likely to contract TB. And that's less true of COVID-19, but I think if we are to manage and prevent these sorts of pandemics in the future, we have to be thinking about what are the lessons that could be learned and what sorts of mistakes have we made in terms of having an unequal country.
A huge thank you to Karina, Sanj and Alison for their fascinating insights into infection prevention control and health policy in South Africa. If you want to find out more about Amoya Amushle, you can visit the website at www.lshtm.ac.uk/UO. We are also starting to upload all the transcripts from our previous podcast episodes, and some are already available, so you can find those on the LSHTM website. Thank you again for listening to LSHTM Viral, and goodbye for now.